Anna Lemke, what are you addicted to?
So in my early 40s, I got addicted to romance novels. And, you know, I don't want to make light of severe life-threatening addictions, because mine certainly wasn't. But I really did develop this compulsive overconsumption of this specific genre of escape fiction, romance novels, that, you know, progressed over time so that it really was impacting my quality of life, my goals and values, my well-being. And, you know, it started with my gateway drug, The Twilight Saga. And for your listeners who are not familiar, The Twilight Saga is a vampire romance novel that was written for teenagers. And in my early 40s, I read it and was transported by it and went from there to reading every vampire romance novel known to humans. And progressed over time to, you know, werewolf romance novels and magician romance novels. And really, you know, you name it, I read it. And eventually, you know, made my way to Frank erotica, you know, culminating in 50 Shades of Grey, which was my, you know, kind of the peak of my addiction, you might say, no pun intended. And so it was a strange thing. It was a strange thing because I'm a psychiatrist. I treat addiction. I research addiction. I mean, I know how it works. And yet I got addicted without really realizing what was happening, kind of made light of it in a kid. Oh, I'm addicted to romance novels. Ha ha. But, you know, what is the definition of addiction? It's continued compulsive use of a substance or behavior despite harm to self and or others. And I was teetering into harm to self and others. I was staying up late almost every night reading, finding that I couldn't fall asleep without reading, and another behavior associated with the reading, which I will leave to your imagination. I was, you know, tired the next day. And then basically the nadir was when I started to bring romance novels to work and was reading in the 10 minutes between patients and kind of said, oh, I think there's something going on here. So yeah, that's kind of my story.
Mine damer og herrer, her er endnu en kendsgerning om hjernen.
Du lytter til en videnskab.dk-podcast, støttet af Lundbeck-fonden.
Som I kan høre, har vi en vaskeægte forsker i studiet i denne udgave af Brainstorm, hvor vi dykker ned i afhængighed. Hvad sker der i hjernen, og hvordan kan en afhængighed afhjælpes? Det er nogle af de spørgsmål, vi skal omkring. Mit navn er Jais Bakstrøm Kok. Velkommen til Brainstorm. And Anna Lemke, thank you for that story, and thank you for participating here in the Brainstorm. And Anna, you are a professor of psychiatry at Stanford University School of Medicine, and you have written a book called Dopamine Nation, which I will refer to later. And you are in Denmark because you're doing a talk at Science and Cocktails here in Copenhagen. And Anna, you are a psychiatrist and a researcher, and you treat patients with addictions. But Anna, firstly, as a researcher and a doctor, what interests and fascinates you about addiction?
Well, I think that addiction is really the modern plague. I think that in this world of overwhelming overabundance, where almost every human behavior has become drugified in some way, that is to say, made both more reinforcing as well as more accessible, more plentiful, more novel, more potent, we're really all struggling with behaviors of compulsive overconsumption. And there's a really fascinating intersection between what happens in the brain as we become addicted and also what is happening in our society. And in this, you know, world in which machines do so much of our work and we have all our basic survival needs met and we have more leisure time and more disposable income, even among the poorest of the poor, I do believe that one of the major challenges for humans going forward is what we're actually going to do with ourselves besides continually consume the products that we make.
Later in the interview, we will talk about how we can get out of our addictions or try to any. Yeah, if we need to try to, I would say I don't have an addiction.
Sure you don't. Yeah. Sure you don't.
Yes, I think so. But yeah, maybe I could just to think about it when we talk and maybe confess in the end of the interview with my addiction. Maybe I have one. But first we have to define addiction. So Anna, what constitutes an addiction?
So addiction is the continued compulsive use of a substance or behavior despite harm to self and or others. It's that when I use the word addiction, I'm talking about psychopathology, right? Mm. I'm not talking about a passion or something that, you know, somebody does intensely. It's really got to kind of teeter into a place where it's interfering with our function, our goals, our values.
It has to do harm.
Yeah, it really has to do harm for us to call it, you know, an addiction. Yeah. I also think it's always important to say that although addiction is a brain disease, there's no blood test for it. There's no brain imaging scans you can do. We still make the diagnosis based on patterns of behavior over time. And of course, you know, much of human behavior is consumptive and is goal-oriented. So the distinction between healthy goal-oriented behavior and addiction really is whether or not it's causing harm to self and or others.
And addiction can be divided into two categories, behavioral addictions and addiction to substance. And behavioral addictions include gambling or addiction to pornography. And the substance addiction can be addiction disorders centered around alcohol or drugs like heroin, amphetamine and cocaine. But Anna, in your book, Dopamine Nation, you also speak about how social media, computer gaming, and your own passion for Twilight novels can lead to this addictive behavior and can lead to harm, even though they are in a clinical sense aren't addictions, if you know what I mean. So how come you speak about social media as an addiction that causes harm?
Yeah, so I think that's good to clarify that when we look at, for example, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, which is sort of our Bible of diagnosing mental illness, it is true that behavioral addictions are not yet included in the DSM. Gambling addiction is sort of soon to be included, but other forms of behavioral addictions, like as you mentioned, to sex, pornography, video games, social media, they're not yet officially regarded as addictions. But I think it will not be long before those are official addictions. And the reason I think that is twofold. First of all, we are seeing more and more cases of individuals seeking help for compulsive overconsumption of behavioral processes, especially digital media. So more and more people coming in with online pornography addiction, online gaming disorders, social media, shopping, cryptocurrency, and other financial investments, just generally watching YouTube or, you know, just being online. So, you know, people are expressing the need for help with those behaviors. The other reason I think that, you know, we will soon universally acknowledge those as brain diseases is because these behaviors light up the same reward pathway in the brain as drugs and alcohol. And so really we are talking about a common process. When we look at the natural history of the disease of addiction, we see the same pattern with drugs and alcohol as we see with people who get addicted to pornography, gambling, etc. People usually start out for one of two reasons: to have fun or to solve a problem.
Now we will talk about what happens in the brain when we get addicted. And Anna, in your book, you describe how the reward system in the brain is highly involved in addiction and that the neurotransmitter dopamine is key to that system. Dopamine is a neurotransmitter that is involved in many, many processes, learning, movement, motivated behavior like seeking food. And Anna, in your book, you also describe the brain's reward system as a system which is designed for a world of scarcity and not the modern Western societies like US and Denmark, where most people have easy access to food, for instance. So what do you mean by this, that our reward system is made for a different time?
Well, I think in order to understand sort of why our ancient wiring is mismatched for our modern ecosystem, as well as what happens in the brain when we become addicted, it's essential to realize that pleasure and pain are co-located in the brain. So the same parts of the brain that process pleasure also process pain, and they work like opposite sides of a balance. So imagine a seesaw, like in a kid's playground. That represents how you process pleasure and pain. When we experience pleasure, it tips one way. When we experience pain, it tips the other. And one of the overarching rules governing this balance is that it wants to remain level. So we have a baseline level of dopamine firing in our reward pathway, and we always want to return to that baseline level. And the way that we return to that baseline level is first by that teeter-totter tilting an equal and opposite amount to whatever the initial stimulus is. So let me explain. We do something reinforcing. In my case, read romance novels. We release dopamine, our reward neurotransmitter, in the reward circuitry in the brain. That pleasure-pain balance tilts to the side of pleasure. But no sooner has that happened than our brain will work to restore a level balance, first by tilting an equal and opposite amount to the side of pain. That's the come down, the hangover, the after effect, that moment of wanting one more romance novel or one more piece of chocolate or one more joint, one more glass of wine. I like to imagine that as these neuroadaptation gremlins hopping on the pain side of the balance to bring it level again, but they like it there, so they stay on until it's tilted an equal and opposite amount to the side.
And I'll just translate the teeter-totter. That's på dansk, det er en vippe. But yeah, Anna, when you say pain, you mean the come down, the hangover, the the uncomfortable experience that you get after the high, so to speak.
Yeah, and it can be subtle. It can be outside of conscious awareness. You know, we can be watching a TikTok video, and even while we're watching that, we're sort of already experiencing the come down from the video, because our brain is trying to balance out, and it balances out by, you know, for every pleasure, we pay a price, and that price is pain. Yeah. And that can manifest as wanting to watch another TikTok video even before the first TikTok video is over.
But this reward system is very useful in a world where you have to be motivated for seeking out food and seeking the bare necessities. Is it the right?
That's right. That's right, because that it means that for every pleasure we pay a price, and a pleasure is fleeting. And so after pleasure we have pain, and that then drives us to want to get the next pleasurable thing, which is great if you're in a world where, you know, getting pleasure is hard and requires a lot of upfront work. It's not so great if you're sitting on your couch and at the touch of a fingertip, you know, you can sort of order everything to your doorstep, or that the device itself is reinforcing.
And which studies is behind the point that pleasure and pain is processed in the same area in the brain? As which sort of evidence do you talk about?
Oh, lots of evidence. So first of all, there's a lot of animal studies showing this. In humans, there are neurophysiological studies, there are electrophysiological studies, there are brain imaging studies. So there's really a wealth of evidence showing this co-location.
Yeah. And you were speaking about this dopamine baseline, which is a natural level of dopamine, which increases or decreases when you do something, or when you drink alcohol or something like that, intake a substance. And you reference rat studies in your book, which show that chocolate increases dopamine by 55% over baseline, sex 100% over baseline, nicotine 150% over baseline, cocaine 225% over baseline, and amphetamine 1000% over baseline. So in this world of abundance, why is it that these temporary bursts of dopamine spikes can lead to addiction? Why is the reward system wired like that?
Right. So what happens in the brain is that, again, with that initial upward spike of dopamine in response to a reinforcer, the brain wants to get back to baseline. And it does that by decreasing dopamine transmission, that is to say, involuting postsynaptic dopamine receptors, decreasing dopamine production, not just back to baseline levels of dopamine firing, but actually below baseline, this dopamine deficit state, before going back to baseline. That's, again, that come down. But with repeated exposure to the same or similar reinforcing stimulus, that initial upward spike gets weaker and shorter, but that downward spike below baseline gets stronger and longer. If you're thinking back to the seesaw or the teeter-totter with the gremlins, you might imagine that as those gremlins on the pain side of the balance starting to multiply, where if you use the drug repeatedly over time, eventually you end up with enough gremlins to fill this whole room, and then they're camped out there. They're not going anywhere fast. So in essence, what happens is because of exposure to these highly reinforcing drugs and behaviors over time, we end up changing our joy or hedonic set point, such that we need more of our drug in more potent forms to get the same effect. And when we're not using, we're walking around in this dopamine deficit state, experiencing the universal symptoms of withdrawal from any addictive substance, which are anxiety, irritability, insomnia, depression, and craving.
And this metaphor with the gremlins, you can see some pictures of that in your book.
That's right.
Addiction comes from the initial spike of dopamine, and that spike gets smaller and smaller, and you have to read more and more Twilight novels to get the same spike going. Yeah.
Not only do you have to read more, but the brain then compensates for all that dopamine upward by settling down, not at the baseline, but actually below baseline. And that is the driver, because when we're in a dopamine deficit state, again, there's an overwhelming physiologic drive for all organisms to go back to homeostasis or whatever our baseline is. And this is not just for the reward pathway. These are many physiologic processes in the body. And so once we're in that dopamine deficit state, the drive to keep using our drug far exceeds its enjoyment level or the way in which it might have previously solved a problem. Now we're using essentially just to try to get out of the dopamine deficit state. We're medicating withdrawal from the last dose. We're not really having fun necessarily or treating an underlying disorder. We're in the vortex of addiction.
Yeah. In your book, you focus a lot on dopamine, and I think this could lead to a misunderstanding that dopamine causes addiction. But addiction is complex, and addiction can have its roots in trauma or mental illness. And in that sense, dopamine is just a neurotransmitter. It's just a messenger. And it is just my view, but I have the impression that some people think, oh, damn you, dopamine. You make me addictive. And that's, in my view, is a misunderstanding. Don't shoot the messenger. Dopamine is the messenger. And it's the reward system, which are highly involved in addiction, but it's not dopamine in itself that causes addiction. What are your reply to that?
Yeah, so that's a great point. Dopamine is our friend. We absolutely need dopamine. It's the neurotransmitter that tells us, oh, this thing that you're doing now, you should pay attention to it because it's potentially very important, right? We reflexively approach pleasure and avoid pain. That is what has kept us alive through millions of years of evolution. Dopamine is the signal to allow us to know when and how to do that. So it's absolutely key. You know, we make it in our brains in response to the things we do and the things that we ingest, and we need it. Dopamine is, for example, very, very responsive to novelty or new things that we have to pay attention to in the environment to know what's going on. Although one thing I would qualify is that I think it is a misunderstanding that addiction is always in response to trauma, for example, or always in response to mental illness. You can have the perfect life, no trauma, no co-occurring mental illness. And just by exposing your brain to a highly reinforcing drug or behavior, you can get addicted because the exposure to the drug itself changes the brain. And this is something that I really think it's important to communicate because we get a lot of patients who come in and say, oh, well, you know, I use drug X because I'm depressed. And if you could just fix my depression, I would no longer use drug X. And the truth is that even if we could magically fix that person's depression, which usually, by the way, we can't because our treatments don't work when people are actively in their addiction. But let's say we could wave our magic wand and get rid of the depression. Once you're addicted, you're addicted. And typically that is not going to resolve just because you take away a co-occurring disorder like depression or just because you do some psychology and figure out the trauma.
We have to talk about what you can do
about addiction.
Mm-hmm. And in your book, Dopamine Nation, you have compiled 10 lessons of balance which are based on your clinical experience treating patients with addiction disorders, and we have time to focus on three.
Okay, great.
And I have picked the three. So the first we have to talk about is this. Recovery begins with abstinence. What do you mean by that?
So basically what this is saying is we have to stop bombarding our reward pathway with these highly reinforcing substances and behaviors for long enough to allow those neuroadaptation gremlins on the pain side of the balance to hop off the balance so that homeostasis can be restored. Said differently, we need to give our brains a break from dopamine and allow that our brains to realize, oh, wait a minute, I'm not getting this external source. I now need to start to upregulate dopamine and other feel-good neurotransmitters so that we can get back to baseline or homeostasis and we can actually objectively observe the impact of the drug on our lives, which is hard to do when we're chasing dopamine, but also recapture our ability to enjoy more modest reinforcers.
And in your book, you write that this takes four weeks.
Honestly, with almost all comers from mild overconsumption to severe addiction, 4 weeks is on average what it takes to reset reward pathways. The first 10 to 14 days are horrible because people are in withdrawal. And by about week four, people are noticeably better. This doesn't mean that, oh, your addiction is cured if you're severely addicted. It just means that's enough time to kind of see the light at the end of the tunnel and begin to appreciate the impact of the addiction on our lives.
Yeah, and it has to be said that if you are addicted to certain substances, it can be amphetamine, it can be quite dangerous for your health if you just withdraw from one day to another. If you do a cold turkey, it can be dangerous. So you have to be assisted by a professional when you begin with your withdrawal. Okay, lesson of balance. Number two,
okay.
Radical honesty promotes awareness, enhances intimacy, and fosters a plenty mindset. How can radical honesty help people with their addiction?
Yeah, so radical honesty is something I learned from my patients in recovery from severe addictions, almost all of whom had realized that they can't lie. And it's not just that they can't lie about their drug use, they actually can't lie about anything. Because lying itself is part of the disease of addiction, and lying can trigger relapse. And I became very, very interested in this. What is it about truth telling, or what I call radical honesty, telling the truth about everything, large and small, that allows people to stay in recovery from severe addictions? And I think it works on many levels, but just to cover the three that you described, it enhances awareness, right? So when we are telling the truth to other humans about what we're doing, how much and how often, it becomes real to us in a way that it's not when we're not talking about it. So that's very powerful. And in becoming real to us, we then have access to information that we can use to inform our choices so that we don't have access to that when we're not talking about it. In terms of the plenty mindset, which I think was the last thing you mentioned there, there's an interesting way in which telling the truth to others and to ourselves also encourages others to tell the truth, and then creates a kind of a communal value around truth telling, which makes the world a more predictable, reliable, and safer space.
The third lesson of balance we have time to talk about is this. Instead of running away from the world, we can find escape by immersing ourselves in it.
Yeah.
How can this help?
Well, I mean, all that running is just exhausting, and we can't really outrun these behaviors. And so there comes a point, you know, in every addicted person's life where they're basically trying to ignore that fact, and they're doubling down on this, you know, sort of defense mechanism around being in denial about the addiction, trying to manage the addiction. But when they come to that place where they sort of admit the addiction or admit the unmanageability, their inability to manage their consumption alone, and they just sort of admit that, that can be a really huge and important turning point. And I think that translates to, you know, other problems beyond addiction, just that when we kind of stop trying to run from the universal suffering of being human, paradoxically, that can alleviate some of our suffering.
Mm. And I've been thinking about what my addictions are, and I would find it very hard to live without podcasts.
I listen to,
I don't know, 20, 25 hours of podcast in my spare time. So
yeah, great.
But I don't experience harm.
Right.
It's not harmful.
Right.
I would also have difficulties living without good wine.
Yeah.
I'm a wine nerd, but I'm pretty close to the recommendations here in Denmark how much it's okay to drink, but maybe I'm in complete denial.
Well, you know, it's a great point. Like, what is the difference between a passion or a hobby, an interest, a passionate interest, and an addiction? And yeah, we don't want to call everything an addiction, because then we really trivialize, you know, behavior that's destructive or harmful. Mm. On the other hand, you're absolutely right. We're not the best observers of when our passions have become problematic. And that's why I do actually recommend a dopamine fast, even if people don't really think they have a problem. It can be very instructive just to kind of, like in your case, like you might try, I don't know, a week of no podcasts. It doesn't have to be 4 weeks. You could just do a week of no podcasts, or you could do a certain period of time of no wine, just to kind of observe, number one, how is that difficult for you to give that up? What kind of withdrawal do you have? Because the withdrawal is often primarily psychological symptoms. Mm. What do you feel like at the end of that? Are there some good things that came out of not doing that for a while?
I will try it out.
Okay.
I promise.
You let me know how it goes.
Yeah, I will. Anna Lemke, thank you very much for being on Brainstorm.
And my
I hope
pleasure.
You enjoy the rest of your stay in Denmark. Og det var alt, hvad vi havde valgt at bringe i denne udgave af Brainstorm. Vi er støttet af Lundbeck Fonden. Jeg hedder Jens Bartram Kok. Tak fordi du lyttede med.